I had given it to God and taken it back 100 times. I mean, I tell Jesus in the morning how much I trust him, and that night I'm kicking down a door with a gun in one hand and a knife in another in some crack house, going in looking for my daughter and taking matters into my own hands. And I did that many, many, many times over 13 years. So one morning, I get up very early. It's like 3 a.m, and I'm doing my quiet time, and I just feel the Holy Spirit present. And I said, God, I've spent 30 years trying to save my daughter. And it's been me on my own strength with my own skills, making all the mistakes I could possibly make. And everything I've done has not only not helped, it's made matters worse. God, I hand this to you. She's your daughter more than mine. And one day I'm taking her son to school. I drop him off. I notice my wife's car is almost out of gas. I pull in, I fill up, and I'm leaving. And I get this powerful message: go to the car next to you. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. Go to the car next to you. Now, I hadn't seen my daughter in 8 months. Like, I hadn't seen her, talked to her, nothing. I get this powerful message. I put it in park. I go stand next to the car. It's a sports car, so I'm like towering above it. I'm just waiting to get shot, basically, because it's got black tinted windows. I can't see in. And finally, the window goes down just about an inch, and somebody leans up and says, "Can I help you?" And I lean down to talk to him, and my daughter is asleep in the passenger side of the car.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Welcome to The Aggressive Life. You know, none of us have a easy, simple story. Some of the people who seem to have everything going well in a direction have pains and pressure points and curveballs that hit them on the side of the head all of the time. That's kind of the story with our guest today, who has gone through hell, and he's helping other people come out of their hell. His name is Scott McClellan. Some would call him a Renaissance man, a man you can't really pigeonhole in a specific place. He spent 25 years as the CEO of a billion-dollar healthcare company. He's led thousands of employees. He's kind of done the CEO thing and enjoyed certain blessings and opportunities that only people in that sort of strata can. And he has had some really, really hard times with his family and around health. You know, studies show that if we don't have a tight community, we're not going to be healthy. And then when we are physically unhealthy, not having a tight community is going to help make it hard for us to actually heal from our difficulties we have. Scott's got some insights on that. He's well-traveled. He's got a lot of good stuff going on. Welcome to The Aggressive Life, Scott McClellan!
Oh, just great to be here, Brian. Thanks for having me on. Love what you're doing with this podcast. So it's an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, tell me about your the health companies you were engaged with. What was all that about, and how long ago was that?
So we had a chance to start a couple of companies along the way. Started a company back in 1999 that was focused on the healthcare space, providing purchasing technology, and that company ended up growing very large and international over time. Second one we started was in the service business. So we would provide services to hospitals and retirement centers with lots of employees who just had a great passion to take care of people at very vulnerable times of their lives.
And did you, when you started those, you kept them going, or did someone buy them, or how did it end?
Both were bought, and they're thriving today under different company leadership. Yeah.
So you are old school entrepreneur.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. It's been fun, adventurous, and crazy, which you would know, starting a church.
Yeah. I certainly have the entrepreneurial thing in me, start a variety of things, but there's very few people actually start something and it's successful and sell something and make a lot of money. There's people who call themselves serial entrepreneurs. It just means that you haven't had anything work.
One way to look at it.
So were you terrified at all when that healthcare executive got shot in New York City several months ago?
Just so tragic. That would have been a good customer of mine. So I would have just been impacted personally by that. But I think all of us just looking at that, how can you not be impacted personally when you see something like that go down?
Right. Yeah. Right. Do you see any changes coming with the healthcare industry? Everybody seems to be just not happy about healthcare. Everybody except, I don't know, somebody at the top who's making a lot of money. I mean, sorry to just call it the way many people see it, the insurance companies, right? I mean, doctors aren't happy because they're not making what they used to. They're hamstrung. Patients aren't happy for the most part because of all the hoops to go through with coverage. Nurses aren't happy. I mean, it's a tough deal. Do you see us ever changing our healthcare system the way it is right now, or just the way it's going to be forever?
I think it'll evolve incrementally. I joined healthcare space back in the early 1980s, and it was the Wild West back when I came in. And it was just the beginning of Bill Clinton coming in and starting managed care. And that was the first opportunity to try to get arms around costs that were happening in healthcare and the way that care would be delivered. And that has morphed, you know, 15 times since then. But I think what you're seeing is people are starting to focus on the wellness of an individual instead of the sickness of an individual. And so I think we're heading in the right direction. I just think it's going to be a long runway to get there before we ultimately see a different kind of environment.
What would be the different kind of environment, do you think?
Yeah, so I think what you're going to find in healthcare is that hospitals are going to become more and more responsible for the cost of a patient's life over time. And therefore, they're going to be incented to make sure you're well, as opposed to incented to manage you and heal you during your sickness. And so you're going to see a lot of programs, whether that's eating well, stopping things that are harmful to you, getting on proper medications earlier. And you'll start to see people kind of enter the space more in a holistic way than just coming in when it's urgent and dire and very expensive things need to happen to get you well.
How would that work? That sounds really exciting and innovating, but how would that work? How would you get paid for somebody being healthy?
So the insurance companies now would pay for a life. So we're going to pay you X number of dollars for the life of a patient. And so now that hospital, instead of being incented to have you come in and treat you, is incented to keep you out of the hospital. And so they might make sure that you're eating right, for example, and put you on a food program at home to get your weight under control, get your diabetes under control, any number of things that will lead to your wellness instead of managing your sickness.
And people would opt into this program. Like, I would agree to that.
That's right. And, you know, you can't force somebody to eat well, but you can incent them to eat well. And you can follow up to make sure that after the first week, they haven't gone back to their same old diet. You can have better metrics around your health. Like, what is your weight doing? What is your A1C doing for diabetes? What is your blood pressure doing? And there are a lot of studies now and a lot of healthcare companies that are built entirely around getting people down to a manageable well condition and keeping them from that ultimate urgent situation where you're having a heart attack or you're broken down and in the hospital getting very expensive treatment.
It's tough, and the cost of healthcare just keeps going up, 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 up. But
it does.
Seems like at some point there has to be a breaking point. Is there a breaking point? Is there something that's going to shove things to change, or you just do believe it's going to be gradual, ongoing evolution, eventually going to catch up?
You know, everybody, I was thinking that back in the 1980s. Clearly, there has to be a breaking point, and so we're still just incrementally, roughly doing the same things today. So it always feels like you're on the verge of that breaking point. And you are starting to see some hospitals close. You're starting to see care move out from the hospitals into outpatient clinics. You're seeing doctors take over things that they only did in the hospital. Now they're doing it outside of the hospital. So you are starting to see it move in the right direction, but it's moving slowly. And I think that's why you see this just constant battle with insurance companies over what's covered and what's not. And we just, with my daughter's life, dealt with that for the last 36 years.
What would be things that doctors are doing outside the hospital that they used to only do inside the hospital?
Well, if you were to get a knee replacement done, 20 years ago, that was only done in a hospital. Today, it's done in an outpatient surgery center that may or may not be owned by that hospital. It might be owned by orthopedic surgeons. MRIs that were only done in the hospital are now done in a doctor's office. So you're starting to see these things go out to where people can manage costs better because they're incented to try to get that cost down to provide that care to you and attract you into their practice.
That makes sense.
Again, gradual shift in incentives, but I think we're a long way off.
So you mentioned your daughter.
Yes.
I figured I'd have you tell your story of your daughter instead of me putting in the intro. Tell us about Amanda.
Yeah, thanks. My youngest daughter, she was born with a very rare illness, a very rare form of cancer that took 2 years to diagnose. And by the time she did get diagnosed, it had taken over her body. And she went into urgent care. That ultimately led to the need for a liver replacement, a liver organ replacement. And she had a liver transplant somewhere around the age of 4, and then ultimately survived cancer 2 more times by the age of 7. And if that weren't enough, that first liver started to fail early, and so she had multiple procedures until she had a second liver transplant at the age of 17. Mm. And so I'd say by the time she was 17, she had over 150 surgeries in her lifetime. Yeah. And at one point, she was the only person alive in the world with her combination of illnesses. And more than once, we took her home to die. We just stopped treatment and brought her home to die. Mm. So she's a walking miracle out there and in a lot of medical textbooks around the world.
For her. How old is she now?
She's 36.
36?
36. And a mother. She wasn't supposed to be able to get pregnant or survive a pregnancy. And here she is. Yeah.
Wow, look at you, Dad, smiling like a butcher's dog over there.
Oh, my goodness. it is just a miracle. And I will tell you, so many times we just didn't think we'd make it through the day. And here she is 36 years later and thriving.
So I'm breaking my rule. I'm breaking my rule right now, Scott, in that I'm tired of talking about cancer. My wife is going through it right now, it's no worries. Thank you. She's doing pretty well, but you know when you have cancer, I don't have cancer, thankfully. But when you're dealing with it, everyone wants to tell their cancer story. Oh, pray for so and so, which is fine. Ask me. I'm honored to pray. I want to be aware of your pain, but at the same time, I had this moment. Last week, while a person was going into it, I thought, you know what? I am OD'd on cancer. I can't hear any more cancer stories. Not right now. I will be able to when she's done. But man, I am head down, and I can't take any more cancer news. It's just tough, right? So, but when I saw it possible for you to come through, I thought, you know, your story for me, from what I know of it, isn't the normal. You know, just cancer, chemo regimen, this, that, and all that stuff, which is important. That's certainly part of your story. But there's a seed of resiliency that I know about you just from knowing what you and Amanda have gone through. And I just don't find many resilient people, or I might also say the word faithful. Mm. I don't find many faithful. I find people are okay with God as long as their life is the way they want it to be. But right. Man, the number of people who all of a sudden struggle with God, leave the faith because they have a life that is difficult. I'm never inspired by that, but I'm inspired by you and your story. So talk more about that. Just keep going.
Oh, thank you. I'll tell you that, and I get exactly what you're saying. I just got exhausted talking about it. And there were very good people who just wanted to pray and wanted to ask and wanted to be involved. But I get it. I mean, at some point, you just want to think about something other than that. But I tell you what, when you're watching your child go through these things and when you see how much fight she has in her, you can't help but as a parent to, you know, go right in with her and just do everything you can to get through. And she had an amazing attitude throughout, just dealt with some of the hardest things that a human being would ever go through. And she dealt with that as a 2-year-old, as a 4-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as a teenager. Going into her second liver transplant, she had her insides were literally rotting. So she had all these tubes sticking out of her body, including a feeding tube because she couldn't eat. And, you know, here she is going through high school, which is hard enough. And she's doing it with, you know, tubes sticking all out of her and just constantly one procedure after the next, and several false starts on the liver transplant the second time around. You know, we would drive 5 hours thinking it was going to happen and it didn't work out. And just the mental toughness that she had to go through. It just, again, you couldn't help but be inspired and jump right in and be there with her.
And you're dealing with all that stuff while you're starting and running companies.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, left a very good company with very good insurance to go start the first company right in the middle of all that, which was either very brave or very stupid. I'm not sure which.
Or very aggressive.
Very aggressive. Yeah, let's call it that.
So let's make sure I get it. You're at a company with great insurance. Your daughter's got all this stuff. You go to start your own thing without insurance.
That's right.
All right. Yeah, see, you're my kind of guy, Jim. You're Scott. That's wow. Yeah. So what's your thinking there when you did that? You're thinking, God's just going to provide. You're thinking, this is going to make so much money eventually. I'll be able to pay off all this debt. Are you thinking like what are you thinking there?
Well, you get to a certain point where one, you decide you have to live your life and you have to live it abundantly. Hmm. You know, you can get so consumed with what's going on with the illness that you know, everything else kind of implodes inward and it just becomes all self-thinking.
Yes.
And so, you know, I wanted to set an example for my family of taking risks, doing hard things, and ultimately going out. And so just decided that that was just as important as everything else that was going on. I was also on the brink of financial insolvency kind of constantly because most of what was happening with her was experimental and not covered by insurance back in the day. Mm. I had plenty to lose with the insurance, but also not a lot to lose financially speaking. So I just took the leap and it ended up working out very quickly, actually. So it's all a God story, all glory to God in all of that.
Took the leap, ended up working out well. You mean the new company went to do took off? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So the new company grew exponentially fast. 6 months of just, and you know, from starting a church, I mean, just 6 months of on the brink of failure every single day. Mm. But then all of a sudden, when it caught and it caught big and fast, and we were actually bringing on so many customers we couldn't keep up. And you know, it went from 0 to $3 billion in revenue in about 18 months.
So, wow. Yeah, 0 to $3 billion in 18 months.
Yeah, it was incredible. Wow. Tough 6 months leading up to that, but fun after that.
Yeah. So you mentioned living abundantly. The Bible says, I've come that they may have life and life abundantly. How does abundant life play out for you in your mind when you're living abundantly? What does life look like?
Yeah, so for me personally, just my makeup is just being constantly on purpose and constantly challenged to create value. And so for me, that just meant going out and not just going into something that was already established and running that, but creating something that would add value to customers, to employees, and to the greater good of the community. And just really blessed to say that both of those companies completely changed the industry that we were in. And in particular, the first one was like a 180-degree shift from where it was to where it is today. And people today just think of it as the standard. That's what we do. But we started that back in June of 99, just trying to create that new way of thinking. So I just like to be out there making things happen and changing the world. One little bit at a time. Yeah,
it's a really good observation and a reminder for all of us, the living abundantly, because we call this the aggressive life. It's all about just take control of your life. You make your choices. Don't be a victim. Push things. But we have to remember, you're not trying to be aggressive simply because you want to be macho or simply you just want to be that kind of person. You're being aggressive because you believe something better will happen on the other side of it. You got a level of faith that something is going to play out. You have a belief that there is abundance out there, not some health and wealth gospel. If God likes you, then, you know, you're going to win the lottery or something like that. But I'm willing to push things because I believe there is a, it sounds crass, but let's just use it. I'm pushing because I believe there's a payday out there. Mm. You know, whether it's financial, whether it's spiritual fruit, whatever. I'm wanting that, and so therefore I've got to push. Agree, disagree? How would you add to that?
Oh, I agree completely. Yeah, and you know, the payday comes in lots of different ways. Certainly, there's financial payday. But there's payday when you're employing 300 people in an organization that didn't exist before. There's payday when you change an industry for the better, when customers are thriving because of the product that you offer. There's payday, I think, spiritually, because you've gone to serve God's people. So that payday comes in lots of different ways, and financially is certainly part of that, yeah.
How would you say that you've changed the industry?
Well, the industry we're in was very opaque. It was not transparent at all. And as a result, people didn't know what they were buying, how much they were paying. And there were certain segments of the industry that were taking advantage of their customers. We added an incredible amount of transparency to that whole process. And the belief was that with that transparency, everyone would benefit, including the people who were trying to hide information at the time. And it's turned out to be true. The group that pushed back the hardest ended up being the most successful in the long run. And it was a great story. They pulled me into their office. Of course, I'm just this little young guy trying to change the world. And they told me that they were going to crush me. I wish I had a recorder in that. and they said, we're going to destroy you. And so I listened to them for like a half an hour. It was eight guys and me just coming after me. And I simply got it from the table and I said, someday you're going to ask me for my business and you're going to be sorry for the way you acted today. 2 years later, they called and said, we're sorry. And we now, that company now has hundreds of millions of dollars with them. So they have benefited in the long run.
Yeah. Wow. That's great.
Yeah, it was fun. Not at the time, but in the long run, it was fun. Yeah.
That takes some chutzpah. What were you doing before, when you were part of a corporation or something like that? But that sounds like one of those Navy SEAL stories. You ever serve in the Armed Services?
Yeah, no, I was doing something related in an industry, and a friend called and said he was doing something in another part of the industry altogether. And he said, I think this will work where you are. And so we kind of jumped in from there. We flew out to California one day and we were seeking a little investment money to get started. And 24 hours later, we had a little bit of start from Silicon Valley, and that got us off from the ground up running.
Yeah. You mentioned before that you wanted a model for your family. How did you put it? Being about outside yourself and getting away from cancer or something like that. I think I know what you're talking about, because one of the things that it's dawned on me is that I can be too quick to play the cancer card. You know, cancer can, and I don't have cancer, but I'm a caregiver of somebody who is going through it. And I'm about myself. I like myself. I'm the favorite thing in my life. Me. Taking care of me is the favorite thing I do. And you know, you can have an extra level of manipulation when you just drop in a call with somebody. I'm sorry, my wife has cancer. You know, I'm ashamed I've done that a couple times. And when I've done it, I thought, wow, I'm using this as an excuse to get my way on some petty little thing, like, you know, just weird. And I'm more aware of my self-focused nature in the midst of this than I ever have been before. And I hate it, and I'm trying to stand against it. So am I reading into what you were talking about? You said you want to make a model for your family and get outside yourself. Was some of that going on with you, or are you talking about something different?
Maybe a little bit, but I get what you're saying, first of all, about that. When your family goes through that much trauma, it can become part of your identity. And you can become the guy with a child with cancer. And, you know, everybody wants to talk about it. And I would regularly get feedback that I wouldn't let people in. And the reason I didn't let them in is I didn't want this to become the topic of conversation. I didn't want my trauma to be what was going on with everybody. And, you know, that led to its own issues, putting all those walls up. But, yeah, I mean, you can just become so inward thinking when you're going through trauma that trauma is what defines you, and the trauma becomes your identity. And there's like a kind of almost a weird payback in that trauma that, you know, you're the guy who's overcoming trauma. And I just wanted to go out and live a life I would have lived without that trauma. And I don't mean that selfishly. I mean that in terms of modeling what it's like to live abundantly, even while you're going through something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she is, you said 37 right now?
36.
36. 36, and what's her health like right now?
She's doing great. She has ongoing issues, so she's mostly deaf, for example, and that happened during all of this. She's got epilepsy that she deals with now, but I mean, compared to what she was going through for most of her life, she's doing miraculously well. It's a testament to the work of God every time I see her and hug her.
Gosh. So it's amazing, but she's still got the battle scars, and it's still real.
Yeah, literally. I mean, she's got scars all over her body, which she just wears, not proudly, but it doesn't bother her a bit that she has those battle scars.
And how about her child, healthy child and everything?
Yeah, he turns 13 in just about a month. We've been raising him since he was born for reasons I'm sure we'll talk about here in a minute. I'm raising a 13-year-old boy in my mid-60s, and it's a blast because he's a great kid. He's outgoing, and he's just coming into that, you know, where he's pushing back against the, not against the male figures, but kind of testing himself against the male figures. Mm-hmm. So I'm having to stay in shape just so he doesn't beat me too bad when we wrestle. Yeah.
So he lives with you 24/7. You're the
24/7 and has since the day he was born. Yeah.
And that's because you said, we'll talk about this, because just your daughter's not capable to handle it on her own.
Yeah, so I think the second part of the story is after she went through everything she did with cancer and many, many other illnesses, during her second liver transplant, she was on heavy opioids for the 2 years leading up to that transplant and the 1 year post that transplant. This was way before the opioid crisis, and it appeared to my wife and I that she was addicted, but the doctors kept saying, oh, you can't get addicted to this stuff, and you know, even if you did, she'd be fine in 30 days. But she was not fine and spent the next 13 years on and off the street living as a hardcore addict and alcoholic.
Oh, my gosh.
Coke, meth, heroin, fentanyl. I mean, the whole thing. Just nonstop hardcore addiction that brought all kinds of elements of criminality into our lives. And, you know, she had multiple overdoses, multiple arrests, and was, you know, brought into a world of violence and criminality that we just never could have possibly fathomed, given everything else that we had gone through.
So she has a son that came about through non-traditional means. Not like she
That's
got
right.
married. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And how, when she's going, I'm just processing this. It's just another level of pain and difficulty for your life.
Yes, that's right.
Wow. It's most of the time people are dealing with the problems of their child, and their child makes their problems with their child, and their child dies, and it's horrible. But to just go from one painful chapter to another over years and years and years and years and years and years and years, man.
Yeah.
Talk about inner resilience that you must have.
Yeah. So again, when it first started happening, you know, again, this was before the opioid crisis, so we didn't even know what addiction was. We didn't have any perspective on what that life was. It was just a total shock to us. And quite frankly, we'd been through so much. This was just another thing we were going to overcome and move on with our lives. But gradually, kind of, it never got better. It just always managed to get worse over the next 13 years. And it went from kind of just managing the situation with her to being totally out of control. And that's both with illness and addiction. You have no control over that circumstance. So as a guy who likes to control everything, I had this whole part of my life that was completely chaotic, completely disruptive, and completely out of control. There was nothing I could do to manage either one of them. And so you just stick with it. I mean, you take what you're handed in life and you press through it and you just do what you got to do to get your family through it.
So when you're in that situation, do you just wipe your hands clean and step back until she wants you to engage? You just completely step out, or are you at all times dabbling in and around as much as she can take?
So at first, dabbling in a lot. But one of the things they tell you with addiction is that you have to let them hit bottom. But addiction manages to redefine bottom constantly. And so you think that your child has hit bottom, and then you find out it's just the beginning. I mean, you have no idea how deep and how bad it gets. And there are times when they tell you to just step out. I could never do that. And my wife and older daughter would think that I was kind of codependent, you know, that I was part of the problem by not stepping out. But then there comes a time when there's so much violence and so much criminality being brought into your household, you have to just say that's enough. You've got to go deal with this. Whenever you're ready for help, we're here, but you've got to go deal with this. But I tell you what, as hard as that was to do, it was even harder to see the consequences of that, because once she was out of the house, it just escalated all the more.
Yeah. Yeah, you saw unsavory characters coming into the house and said, no, we can't have any of this at all. Got to get out.
Yeah, I mean, people breaking into our house, doing drug deals in the basement, people threatening our lives, people threatening my daughter if we didn't pay up. It got very, very intense fairly quickly once it started to escalate.
Wow. Wow. How long did you live with that sort of scenario, Scott?
So it was probably 3 or 4 years in the house where we dealt with that, and then off and on for the next 9 or 10 years after that, where, again, she's couch surfing, literally living on the street, you know, in rehabs, in jail, just multiple times. Just you never knew from one day to the next where she was going to be, what the call you were going to get, because she overdosed about 5 times. And so we'd get a call from the hospital, you better get here because she's not going to make it through the night. And, you know, or I'm in jail, Dad, come bail me out. You know, you just never knew what was coming. It was literally a minute to minute kind of thing, especially when she was present, because you never knew which version of her you were going to get.
So in that situation, are you just trying to dust off yourself and just completely separate yourself? Or are you saying you're the one, the family, who couldn't do that and the other ones could?
Yeah, so I had so much of my life invested in, my empathy with what she had gone through as a child. And this addiction that had started came through no fault of her own. She was medically addicted before she became, you know, addicted by choice.
Right.
And I couldn't bear to watch my girl go through this. I just kept reaching out. I kept trying to help. I kept trying to convince. In the early stages, I'd still provide financial support, but that all got sold. You know, I wouldn't give her cash, but I might buy her a grocery card or something, but she'd just sell that for cash and use it to buy drugs. And again, it was just constant shakedowns, constant calls for cash, constant ask for help. And eventually, I finally got to the point where I didn't, but probably stuck with that too long.
What was the turning point for her? Or is there no turning point? I'm sorry. I'm assuming that everyone's good right now, but is everything okay and there was a turning point?
There was a turning point. And again, she's sober now 5 years, which in and of itself is miraculous. Yes. She'd been through 13 rehabs that didn't help. Again, multiple arrests. None of that shocked her out. Five overdoses where, you know, she just found herself waking up in a shower somewhere with people trying to revive her. None of that did anything. But she ultimately, and I'll tell you the story if you like, kind of when I ultimately gave it to God, God stepped in. And did miraculous things, brought a man into her life who is her husband today, a very good man from a very good family. His mother is one of the most Holy Spirit driven women I've ever met. She starts praying over her and prophesying, and it took about a year. I mean, it wasn't like all of a sudden she was good, but a year later she was completely sober, reconnected with our family, reconnected to her son, and again, what sounds normal to most people, hey, my daughter lives near me and she's doing well, is just above and beyond supernatural answer to prayer. And it's just something I'm grateful for every time I see her.
When you, quote unquote, gave it to God, was there a moment, a prayer, a time when you said, I am literally giving this to him? Can you remember that moment?
I can tell you exactly how it happened. Yeah. I had given it to God and taken it back 100 times. I mean, I tell Jesus in the morning how much I trust him. And that night I'm kicking down a door with a gun in one hand and a knife in another in some crack house, going in looking for my daughter and taking matters into my own hands. And I did that many, many, many times over 13 years. So one morning, I get up very early. It's like 3 a.m. and I'm doing my quiet time and I just feel the Holy Spirit present.
Yeah, 3 o'clock in the morning. I normally have my quiet time. 3 o'clock's still late for me. Dirt, I'm generally at three in the morning, I'm generally interceding for the nations.
That's right. You've been for an hour already. And
Right. Yeah. I've had my scripture memory time from 2 to 3. And then, So go ahead. Yeah, you have your quiet time at 3 o'clock. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm an insomniac. What can I say? So I feel the Holy Spirit present, and all of a sudden sitting in the chair doesn't feel holy enough. I get on my knees. That doesn't feel right. I get on my elbows. That doesn't feel right. And so now I'm literally prostrate out on the floor and just this pouring out of the Spirit. And I said, God, I've spent 30 years trying to save my daughter. And it's been me on my own strength with my own skills, making all the mistakes I could possibly make. And everything I've done has not only not helped, it's made matters worse. God, I hand this to you. She's your daughter more than mine. And if I get a call in the next 10 minutes, she's dead. I'm going to know you took her and that she's with you. If she's a drug addict for the rest of her life, I'm going to love her as a drug addict for the rest of her life. And this goes on, and I feel like supernatural peace for like 2 weeks. One day I'm taking her son to school. I drop him off. I notice my wife's car is almost out of gas. I pull into a gas station and it's all full, and 10 minutes go by and I get frustrated and I leave. I'm heading out. Kind of see backwards from me another gas station that's open. I pull in, I fill up, and I'm leaving, and I get this powerful message: go to the car next to you. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. Go to the car next to you. Now, I hadn't seen my daughter in 8 months. Like, I hadn't seen her, talked to her, nothing. I get this powerful message. I put it in park. I go stand next to the car. It's a sports car, so I'm like towering above it. I'm just waiting to get shot, basically, because it's got black tinted windows. I can't see in. And finally, the window goes down just about an inch, and somebody leans up and says, "Can I help you?" And I lean down to talk to him, and my daughter is asleep in the passenger side of the car.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I mean, and she gets out, we reconnect. That man is now her husband. I later meet his family. Wow. And they're just, again, praying over her, prophesying over her, and just bringing her back to health. And so when I finally gave it over, God stepped in this very powerful way. He had already answered the prayer. I just didn't know it yet.
How did she meet this guy who had a sports car? And this guy was not in the drug business.
Yeah, no, not at all. I thought so with the car he was driving.
Yeah, right.
But, no, he's just a very good man from a humble family. And they actually met online. And they got together and made a connection. And he's just done nothing but love and support her. And so I look at her and she's loved and cared for. And it's beyond any dream I ever had, you know? God gave exceedingly abundantly upon, you know, more than anything I could imagine. So,
wow. So she's in a healthy marriage here right now.
Healthy marriage in a home. I know where she lives. I can go hug her and talk to her. I text, talk to her, see her almost every day, as I do my other daughter as well. Which again, sounds normal to a lot of people, but again, this is beyond anything I could have ever envisioned would happen. Yeah.
How is the family, like your other daughter, is the trauma over, or is the bitterness still persisting and there's still memories that got to be talked about and stamped out? Because, you know, you're Amanda put, I mean, she put everybody through a whammy for a long, long, long time. You don't just say, oh, good, they're now married happily ever after. Yeah. What's the healing process been like for everybody else?
Yeah, great question. In particular, for my oldest daughter, who's an amazing woman of God. She does prison ministry. She's a believer. She's married also to a very good man who's a wonderful believer. And she works hard, and she's always been the dependable one. But when she saw what my daughter was doing to the family and doing to her as well, because she went to the same school, so she got painted with the same brush as my youngest daughter, they didn't talk for over 10 years. And if I even mentioned that they might ought to talk, you know, it became a whole thing for hours and days after that I would have even dared to, you know, recommend reconciliation. But because she's such a believer, she ultimately did forgive her sister, and they're not best friends now, but we are out together. We used to have two Christmases, two Thanksgivings, you know, everything, one for each daughter. But now, you know, we're out on a boat together for 6 or 7 hours, and they're talking and hugging, and they got a long way to go. They're rebuilding, but it's coming back.
So is this part of your little mini series, River Soul? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, so the mini series is based on a book I wrote called An Acre of Fools, which is kind of semi-autobiographical. It's a work of fiction, but it's basically follows the story of our family. River Soul is a movement where our entire family wants to serve other families. For years, we kept our story just to ourselves, but our family now wants to serve. We want to, you know, I heard a great expression once, your healed pain can break someone else's chain. And so we want to take all the pain that we had and turn it into a ministry to serve other families going through this. Because when you enter this space, you have no idea the whirlwind you've entered into. You have no idea the chaos that's about to descend on your family. And we want to provide tools, resources, testimonies, and just a community so that they know they're loved, they know they're cared for, and they have information to educate themselves on what to do next.
God doesn't waste anything, does he?
Not a thing. Yeah.
So what's next for you? Is this going to be your next career here? Is producing things? And well, what's it look like for you?
So I retired. I feel like I was called out of the workplace by God. I didn't know what for. So I'm now assuming this is it. So I'm trying to launch a book, a TV series, and a ministry all at the same time. So it's become actually almost as much work as I had before. But it's a joy. It's a passion project. It's on purpose. It's what I think God has called me and the family to do. So it's been a joy to get out there and make all this happen.
For people who are in situations where they've lost all control, which is your situation, which is really especially hard for someone who is always in control, right? I mean, you're not a CEO and starting stuff unless you're pretty smart, and that comes with you always being in control. You don't, I mean, you answer to a board and stuff, but really you're always the most powerful person in the room. You always have the most resources in the room. You have a track record of making the right decisions. That's why you've gotten to your position. And so all of that stuff is now gone, where you're helpless, and now you can't control anything. A lot of parents feel that way. What counsel would you have for people who feel like they've just lost control?
Yeah. So I'll speak for me personally, but I'm sure this is true for all of us. I think thinking that we're in control is the great myth of for people of faith, that we actually have some element of control. And I think For me, it took 30 years of trauma and chaos and brokenness to kind of come to the point where I realized I was not in control, that the God of the universe is in control, and that I needed to come under that before I could ever kind of regain some semblance of control. So I look back on 30 years of all of that and just thank God for it, because I never would have gotten to the point where I am with the gospel if I had maintained that position where I was in control, thinking it was me that was making things happen, and he needed to break me to break my heart to turn me into the man of faith that I hope I'm becoming today. So I would look at it as, you know, it's kind of cliche to look at it as a gift, but I would just say try to see what God is up to while you're going through that, and try to remember that as soon as you actually sincerely give it to him, that he's going to step in and do miraculous things.
On the practical side, if someone has lost control, well, that is practical. Thank you very much, Scott. That is leaning into God, putting your faith in him, that's very, very practical. Tactical. If somebody is in that situation, a parent, what's a tactical thing they probably should do that they don't think of or are not considering?
Yeah, so if we're talking specifically about addiction, it's educate and communicate. It's learn about addiction, learn about what resources are in your community. Make sure you've got the rest of your family unified, because that is so key. And then be able to communicate with the addicted loved one. And that's going to involve a lot of truth and grace. There's going to be a lot of really hard discussions and a lot of really hard decisions that you're going to have to make. And just be prepared for that. Just recognize that's part of the process. But I think if you provide that truth and grace, if you provide a safe landing when they actually decide they want a safe landing, and that you're constantly reaching out. You know, my daughter was living on the street. I would find her and take her out to lunch, as hard as that was. To just keep a constant presence and constantly remind her she's got a safe place to go when she ultimately decides she wants that safe place. And so you've got to stay in touch. I think the cut them off and let them hit rock bottom, I get that. I just don't think it's the best advice.
Well, you described it well, too. That bottom is just the beginning of a new bottom.
Right.
It's hard to know when that is.
Yeah, and it could be too late. Based on what the drugs are that are out there today.
The work of a father never ends, does it?
Never.
Would have thought probably when you've had your first kid, I'm going to be on point for 18 years here. And then, they'll kind of need me for college savings if they decide to go to college. So I got to do some, and then they'll need me to just be there and give them away and pay for a wedding or two or something like that. They'll need that. But the heavy lifting is done. No, lifting is never done. It just is different, right?
Yeah, that's right. Now I just try to support them in their marriages. Again, they're both married to very good men. All four of them, both my daughters and their husbands, love Jesus and are deep believers and deep people of faith. So I just try to be that strong male presence. And then I get to do it all over again with my grandson. So I get to actually be grandfather and father all at the same time. So that's been pretty awesome. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And you're able to wrestle around with him. He's kind of that kind of kid.
Yeah, he's becoming quite a little man. Doing everything he can to show his strength and his skills, and he's got them. He's showing off what he's got. Yeah.
Well, Scott, give us a little pointer and a little advertisement for your projects and River Soul. People want to get involved, engage, find out more, follow along. How do we do that?
Yeah, so if you feel so inclined, I'd encourage you to buy the book, An Acre of Fools, which kind of is a chronicle of everything we just discussed here. I'm taking all of the proceeds from that book, and I'm investing it right back into the ministry. The ministry is called River Soul, the River Soul Movement, S-O-U-L. Because our healing began on the banks of the river that we live on, and soul because we want to be a safe harbor for the soul when people are going through very dark spiritual times. And there are a couple of ways to access that movement. It's just the very beginning, just the tip of the iceberg of what we hope to do. They can see the technology by texting the words River Soul, S-O-U-L, to 53123, and you'll get access to what we're trying to accomplish that. They can also go to riversoul.org and access the ministry there as well.
That's excellent. Scott, this has been fantastic for all of our listeners. I think I need to hear pretty frequently a story of pain and suffering that's worse than mine. You know, it's not just because I go, oh man, my problems I guess aren't that bad, but it's also an inspiration to see, no, it's really possible to be faithful in the midst of some horrific things. So I don't know what our application could be here today. It's called The Aggressive Life because we want to do things, not just think things coming out of this. Maybe it is, yeah, you're supposed to go start a business. Maybe that is. Maybe it is you're supposed to reinitiate contact with a lost child. Maybe it is you're supposed to step in and go through a door with a gun and a knife. Maybe, I don't know what it is, but there's something that you're going to have to do to be faithful, and I encourage you to do it. Anything else you want to say, Scott?
Oh, I just appreciate the time today. And I will just kind of finish with, I think the answer to every problem is a strong faith and a strong family. So I think if you got the men out there that are leading their families, those are the two objectives. And I think if you do that, you solve almost every problem.
Yeah, that's great. Well, hey, thanks for being an open book and for being faithful. And we'll see you next time on The Aggressive Life.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this journey toward aggressive living. Find more resources, articles, past episodes, and more at briantome.com. My new book, a 60-day devotional called The 5 Marks for Man, 60 Days to a Powerful Life, along with all the other books in the 5 Marks library, are open right now on Amazon. Be sure to leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. Then send an email to dirt@briantome.com to get a free Aggressive Life sticker. Find more on Instagram @BrianTome. The Aggressive Life is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hey, it's Boxer.
And I'm Sarah Towns with Experience Columbus.
Did you know Columbus is home to the number one science museum in the country?
Ranked number 7 on Food & Wine's list of America's next great food cities?
And one of Condé Nast Traveler's top 10 best big cities in America?
Yes, Columbus. An Experience Columbus podcast keeps you in the know about what's happening in the Arch City.
Binge, listen to all the current episodes.
Or catch up on all things Columbus and discover what makes this city so special.
By the end, you'll be asking yourself, can all of this really exist in one city?
Yes, Columbus.